And that really is, what was mentioned before, this really is a continuation of our 1980 plan and how we want to accommodate growth in our centers and corridors. That said, there are some trends that begin to influence, and we can talk about how this plan syncs up with those trends. In terms of people and housing and demographic trends, one big one is the shrinking household size, and that we expect up probably on the order of 60 to 70% of the growth to be in 1- and 2-person households. And we expect that the number of Portland households with children will grow, but not as fast as those 1- and 2-person households. I think the other that Andre mentioned is diversity. Since 1980, we've seen a huge increase in the diversity of our population, especially in terms of the growth of Hispanic and Asian households, and we expect that to continue. If you look out at East Portland and the school-age population out there, many of the schools in East Portland are, the majority of students are people of color. And so we expect that diversity trend to continue as well. I think one of the things that we also look at in this are locational preferences. And, you know, the surveys that we do and see and the sort of back to the city movement that is a national movement, it's what Joe Courtwright talked about, is that people want to live in walkable neighborhoods. They want the house a few blocks off of Division. The market really is reflecting that desire. There's on page 12 of your packet, there's a map that is sort of the overlay of the last 5 years of development permits on our complete neighborhoods, which are shown in yellow. About 75% of the development activity are in these complete neighborhoods, and really focused around the central city and the inner neighborhoods. And what we talked about earlier and the plan to grow those purple areas, to create more complete neighborhoods, to begin to spread that growth and meet that market demand for these walkable neighborhoods. In terms of income, the income disparity is one of those things that's is part of the housing affordability crisis. That we see the number of middle income jobs is dropping both nationwide and in Portland, although we still have a pretty strong core to that. We would classify about 57% of our jobs in Portland are in that middle income, middle range area. But on the other hand, we've seen most of the wage growth in the high income occupations, whereas the middle and low income occupations have been flat. And so in a case where you have rising housing costs and flat incomes, that really creates that pinch in terms of housing affordability. In terms of jobs, there's some graphs and charts on page 10 of your handout. Portland is pretty fortunate to have a pretty balanced economy in terms of our sectors and where those jobs are located, whether it's in the central city or our industrial area or our medical and higher ed institutions or in our neighborhood commercial districts. We're pretty balanced, and we want to maintain that balance. And, as was what Andre alluded to before, is that we have a pretty robust recovery, and Portland is leading the state in job growth. Where this plan really focuses, and you'll hear a lot of testimony on, is around the industrial lands piece of it, because that is where we have our tightest land supply, and that's where we think it's most critical to a middle-income job growth strategy. We have a good industrial base to build from, through the Great Recession, we saw some job losses there, not as much as the rest of the country, so we have a good base to grow. At the same time we saw those job declines, we saw lots of increases in industrial land development, in freight movement, in added value of manufacturing products, that shows that we can do more in terms of economic activity with the land base that we have. And that's really sort of the core function that we'll get to in our economic session later in October.
And that's the October 29th
yes.
session. Because, you know, I think it was noteworthy. I mean, Andre made this statement pretty flatly, and the commission has concluded that there is sufficient land in each category. Right?
Yes.
Not just that there's sufficient land.
And that's
land
what we need to show.
If the economy moves around in some other way, but there's sufficient land in each category, and that's going to be something I bet the council and certainly the community is going to want to bear down on. Really? Is there really? You know, and that'll be the test for that analysis, not just people's assumption about whether we have enough land or not, but that analysis of what it shows.
Right. And finally, you know, back to housing, we've done a lot of sort of modeling of housing types and thinking about household sizes and how they match up. I think that the big takeaway here is that if you look at, and Eric will get a little bit into this, the focus of growth in our centers and corridors matches well with a shrinking household size and lots of 1- and 2-person households. And those 1- and 2-person households, we'll talk about this next week at the housing, are a range of people. It's not just young people getting out of high school and out of college, but it's also elderly households that are empty nesters and are wanting to age in place in their communities. And creating those housing choices in our centers and corridors is really a key theme in our growth management strategy. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Eric to dive a little deeper into that.
Thank you, Tom. I mentioned earlier that part of the exercise is to look at alternatives as we form our preferred plan. And we did that through something called the Growth Scenarios Report, which is one of the deliverables that we're bringing to you. The purpose of that exercise was to look at not just go beyond how much growth we expect, but where do we expect it to happen given our current zoning and current development trends. So we look at things like building permit activity and such as the map Tom showed earlier. We look at what our zoning allows relative to what's happening. Back to what Tom said about the different types of households and jobs, different types of housing and different kinds of employment have different land needs. That's kind of the key principle to this kind of analysis, where you look at, albeit simplified, but look at the different housing types that we expect to need in the next 20 years, and then look at where our zoning allows that type of housing. And it's essentially an analysis to figure out if that matches, if the need matches the supply we can provide. So it's breaking down the overall statement that we have enough land into its constituent parts to making sure that statement still holds up when you dig down into the depths of the different types of housing and the different types of jobs. That's laid out in this report. I'm not going to get into the details of that right now because it's a lot of information, but it is important for underpinning, especially when you're looking at the map, that whether we've provided a map that includes the kind of things that we need in terms of housing and jobs. A couple conclusions from this report that I want to highlight. One I already mentioned, which is it's from an infrastructure perspective, it's maybe this is obvious, but it's less expensive if you put growth where you already have infrastructure. And you know that plays out because if we can't accommodate that growth, it gets accommodated at the edge of the UGB where greenfield development can be quite expensive in terms of street systems and sewer systems. So it's important to keep that in mind. It requires investment on our part to handle that growth, but in many times we're going to pay for it anyway if it goes somewhere else because of the expense of that. Another major conclusion was that, as Tom mentioned, unlike the 1994 situation, we have enough land supply, especially on the residential side, that we don't need to engage in a large-scale upzoning program with quotas for each district of the city and that sort of exercise. This is much more of an exercise about what kind of city we want to be and what can optimize, you know, be less expensive for us to grow and what can create great places, as the mayor mentioned. So that's a key message, is that, that this plan doesn't come with large amount of upzoning, but it does include change. We mentioned also that there's this simultaneous public investment and growth strategy where you need to invest in the places that are not yet complete, but also be ready to absorb a lot of growth in those places where there's already complete neighborhoods. And that goes back to the purple areas on that map that Susan referred to. Another lesson from this analysis is that the central city can absorb a large share of our growth in places like the River District, Lloyd District, continued build-out of South Waterfront. The balance that needs to happen, though, is that the form of housing that occurs in those places may not be the most affordable housing for all household types, and so it needs to be balanced by lower-rise, essentially wood-frame construction opportunities elsewhere in the city. So we can't fully absorb all of our land needs in the central city because the housing mix wouldn't be the right housing mix for the type of households that we expect. And affordability would be the biggest issue there. So we have recommended a hybrid approach where we are still recommending a very strong presence of the central city in our growth scenario, but we need to also accept growth elsewhere.
Quantify that central city portion for us?
Yeah, the recommended plan is approximately a 30-50-20 split, where you have about 30% of the growth in the central city districts that I mentioned, about 50% in the centers and corridors outside the central city, and then about 20% as infill in residential neighborhoods, preferably in places that are within walking distance of those centers and corridors or the central city. So it breaks down about that way.
Still pretty robust. Again, on an annual basis, that's 4,000 people a year moving into the central city.
Over 20 years, it's a doubling of the current central city population. So it is significant. But again, many of the infrastructure investments needed to support that are already in place in terms of things like the streetcar loop and the park system in the Pearl District and continued investment in the Lloyd District. So we think we need to take advantage of that past investment and fully build out that vision. The last thing I'll mention in terms of lessons learned is east of I-205, one of the things that really was striking in the analysis is that one of our metrics was access to living wage jobs, and it's very striking that if you look at the commute shed of jobs that pay a living wage and you know which part of Portland is within 60 minutes of those kind of jobs by transit, East Portland is left out. And so it implies that we need to do more to grow the glow employment opportunities east of I-205 as part of this plan. And there have been some specific land use changes we've made along those lines.
Can I just jump in on that for a second? Because it's something that Tom mentioned and now you've mentioned about the kind of jobs we want to grow and where people live that are in the various jobs. So this handout you gave us has, in under equity and inclusion, has income distribution, City of Portland, by quintile. Do we have a map that identifies where people live by quintile?
We could provide some further analysis.
I'd love to see that. And then would that allow us to look east of 205 and get a clear sense of the distribution of middle-income jobs and where people live?
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I think that's important is that the other big complex issue we're going to be talking about at this body is Superfund. And why not do them all at once, Charlie? I think that was your view. Just
all
pile them. So Superfund is interesting because we always assume that there's about 40,000 river-dependent jobs, and we further assume that those are good family wage jobs, and they are. And so if we're going to strike the right balance between a healthy river and a healthy working harbor, one of the things I think we also have to be thinking about is where do those folks live and how do they get to and from work? And to what extent are those jobs critical to East Portland prosperity? By sort of thinking about where do folks live and those, if we preserve those jobs while also protecting the harbor, is that a strategy that helps build prosperity or stability in East Portland?
East Portland residents, and we have looked at these numbers in terms of where different neighborhoods commute to, and East Portland disproportionately commutes to the Columbia Corridor and the harbor relative to the rest of the city, less to the central city than the older neighborhoods of inner Portland.
So those transportation issues about how we make sure the public transportation is working, those are stable jobs that we want to make sure we don't inadvertently run out of town, and we want to also find out what are the growth areas that we can invest in if those are jobs that are creating stability as well.
So do we, when we do our job analyses, do we look at what's going on in Fairview and Troutdale and Beaverton, Hillsborough, and because you know people can commute to those places too very easily, and those are areas where jobs are growing.
When we do the industrial and the economic development section work session, we'll bring all that in. Part of it also is you want to be able to provide the transportation so that people can commute to where the jobs are, but we're also looking at some zoning changes along 82nd and areas there. Is there an opportunity to bring some more industrial and middle-wage jobs closer to East Portland? And so that's something we'll be talking through with you, too.
The key is the one-hour commute, so it takes longer to get to Hillsborough from East Portland.
The last thing I want to mention before we open it up for further discussion is, as we talk about the growth in different parts of the city, we've tried to create a common language to facilitate this discussion by using consistent terms like town center, neighborhood center, corridors, and try to define what level of growth we mean or what level of growth is implied by our growth plan in these different places. And on page 22 and 23 of your handout here, we've included some drawings just to give you a sense of these terms and the scale of different place types in the plan. And we've done this to facilitate discussion and debate about what kind of place each neighborhood wants to be. And so you are going to get some testimony from different neighborhoods around the city with different aspirations where on the spectrum they want to land in terms of the development of growth. And we've this terminology ranges all the way from small dispersed nodes of mixed use all the way up to the largest node of the central city. And just want to make that clear that that's part of the plan. And the document that's underneath the mayor's microphone there, the urban design direction, it's not formally part of the plan, but it's a communication piece that just has some of this terminology laid out in a more concise document for readers. And all of the detailed materials from that are also in the plan. So at this point, we'll open it up again for other discussion.
Maybe you want to just move on and then come back.
Sure.
I think that's probably best.
Yeah. So the final topic we want to talk about now, Michelle Koenig-North is going to join us. She worked on the citywide systems plan. We've talked a lot about putting growth where there is great infrastructure, that there's obviously, you talk about this all the time here in this room, about the need for repairing and maintaining and improving the infrastructure that we have, but also that we do need to grow that infrastructure in the future. The citywide system plan is the tool that we use. It's a 20-year plan. It's required by the state. It has information in it on the existing condition of Portland's public facilities. It talks about the current and future levels of service that we estimate are needed and about future investment needs. All of this was done with the bureaus that actually maintain and own all of the infrastructure. So we were working with transportation, water, sewer, watersheds, and stormwater, all of that, those bureaus in particular. And that's all that the state requires. But in talking with the bureaus, literally a couple of years ago, they very much told us that there were other infrastructure, things like parks and natural areas, recreation facilities, this building, the Portland building, other police and fire stations and other facilities that are very much and our technology assets came up as very much infrastructure of the city that makes it work and makes it run. We also briefly talked about electricity and natural gas and other services that in some cities would be part of this plan, but those are privately owned, so we don't include them in this plan. Again, those things are all integrated together. So Michelle's job was to corral all of the information basically from the base plans that these different departments already had, that these bureaus had, to compile them together, to look at them, to make sure that they were looking at equity needs, to make sure they were looking at the variety of infrastructure needs, and to put that together in the plan. We have included, again, not just what the state requires, but more, and that was something that the bureaus wanted and that the very much the Planning and Sustainability Commission wanted to have in there. You, of course, have the option to pull those things out if there was something that you decided, because it's not a requirement to the state. I'll hand it over to Michelle.
Before I go any further, I do want to acknowledge, as Susan mentioned, that this was very much a multi-bureau effort. And so I'm here representing the Citywide Systems team, a multi-bureau coordination group who played a really key role in developing the plan you see before you, this one with the open dot. This included Courtney Duke from the Bureau of Transportation, Susan Aldrich and Sarah Culp from the Bureau of Environmental Services, Mike Saling with the Portland Water Bureau, Sarah Huggins from Portland Parks and Recreation, and Susan Hartnett and Eric Olson from the Office of Management and Finance, who also then worked with the Portland Police Bureau, Portland Fire and Rescue, the Bureau of Technology Services, and the Bureau of Internal Business Services to really put together the plan that you see before you. The Bureau of Planning and Sustainability convened and facilitated that group and the production of the plan. So I want to talk today, it's a pretty weighty plan, but we would like to give you just a brief overview of the investment strategies included in it. And I'm going to be speaking from pages 24 and 25 in your pocket, if that's helpful. So first, broadly, the city's infrastructure will need a range of investments over the next 20 years. Similar types of things that we've been doing for the past 20 years, but it's projects to maintain the infrastructure that we have today to make sure it continues to meet community needs, continues to work efficiently, and reliably serve Portland's residents and businesses. We need to invest to resolve system deficiencies in places where our current infrastructure doesn't meet those basic levels of service, doesn't provide the infrastructure services it's designed to, and also to meet state and federal requirements. And finally, as Eric mentioned, we'll need to invest to meet future needs by upgrading or replacing facilities to meet changing or growing demands. So in total, these investments are really designed to meet the broad principles of the comprehensive plan, to support a resilient economy, to protect human and watershed health, to reduce risks from climate change and natural hazards, and to improve equity across the city. And I do want to call out that the Citywide Systems Plan, like the larger comprehensive plan, really supports considering equity impacts throughout the infrastructure planning process, including long-range planning, like the plan you see in front of you, all the way through project design and implementation. It lays out a series of questions about who benefits from an investment, who is burdened, who pays, and who decides, and also proposes an investment strategy for the city's centers and corridors to tailor investments, improve equity, and make sure that Portlanders live in healthy, complete, and prosperous neighborhoods. So I want to pause and kind of dive into that investment strategy for a minute. If you take a look at the, I'll just call it a bubble diagram, this red and gray diagram in your packet. What you see there, the various circles represent the neighborhood, town, and town centers, as well as Gateway and the central city across the city. As you go from left to right across the page, you're seeing the areas on the right-hand side are those that are expected to see more growth and be larger in 2035. On the vertical axis, it's the lower side are those with lower needs from an infrastructure and community amenity perspective. Those towards the top of the page have higher infrastructure needs that have greater current deficiencies. They might lack transit or access to parks, or may not have vibrant commercial districts to serve nearby residents.
How did you decide which ones are going to get more population in 2035?
So that was based on the growth scenarios work. And I can let Eric dive into the details.
It's partly what is zoning allow, but also what are building permit trends from the past, and how are those trends expected to change. So it's the growth scenarios computer model that we run, which looks at, given our zoning and given our land use plan, where is growth likely to occur given certain trends and economic situations.
But we're going to change the zoning in some of these places, right?
Yeah, so the model runs on the proposed zoning, not the existing.
And how did you decide what proposed zoning should be?
There was an iterative process, running the model first with the existing zoning and seeing where the issues were, and working with the Planning Commission to look at alternatives to that pattern, and then agreeing on a set of changes to make, and then running the model again.
What's the difference between the red and the gray?
The red and gray represent, I can't see from here whether, but it represents communities with a higher proportion of vulnerable populations, including lower income residents, the communities of color, renters.
The red circles are those with higher concentrations of populations who might be more vulnerable.
One other question: as you read this chart, how does this chart answer the question, "What investment strategy?"
That's a perfect segue. So I did want to dive into, So this chart is setting up two things. One, that places are different. They are in different places now. They will be in different places down the road. And so I want to just walk through those investment strategies, and I'm going to start in the upper right and go counterclockwise. So the places in the upper right, like Lentz, Rosewood, Gateway, are those that are expected to see high growth, but also currently have high needs, have high levels of deficiency. So in these places, we're proposing to focus city investment on providing that basic infrastructure, accommodating the future growth that's expected, enhancing neighborhoods so they become those complete communities, and supporting economic development and affordability. In the places in the upper left, so Park Rose, Cully, West Portland, these are areas that have existing needs and infrastructure deficiencies, but they're not projected to see as much growth. So the focus here is really on improving equity by addressing those existing gaps. In those in the lower left, areas with relatively complete infrastructure now that aren't expected to see high levels of growth, Montevilla, Roseway, the focus is on maintaining what we have, making sure we can continue to provide services to the residents and businesses in those areas. And finally, for the places in the lower left, these are areas with pretty lower right. I was really bad at Twister. These are areas with relatively complete existing infrastructure systems, but where we're expecting to see a lot of growth. Central City, a lot of the inner east side centers. The city's goal should really be both to maintain and improve existing infrastructure so it continues to provide services, and also work to maintain affordability and allow the growth that we were talking about earlier so that more people can take advantage of these complete areas.
Let me just jump in for one sec, because when we first did this, it was like this big aha moment, because we were just using words, and we said, no, we need a picture that can put this in a way that we can all talk about the different sort of quadrants. And one thing this doesn't do, though, is it doesn't really tell you how many people are in each one of the quadrants in the now and in the future. So we'll bring that information back, because I think it really does help look at, well, sort of two questions you're looking at are, one, bang for the buck. So which areas should we be investing in to affect the most people who are going to come here? And then second, who are those people? So if you may decide you wanted to put something that had, the most bang for the buck, but then it's not helping people who are on the margin or that need more help and need those, need to get to certain jobs. And so you may make decisions for another reason other than just delivering sort of just on the straight growth strategy. And that's why I think both everybody's here kind of keeps coming back to this issue of equity is we don't just want to do, you know, put everybody in the central city and have that be the most efficient, because efficiency is not our only goal here.
So I wanted to spend the rest of the time that I have talking specifically about the investment needs for each of the bureaus that are represented in the citywide systems plan. So the citywide systems plan and the accompanying list of significant projects, which is a is actually included as an element of the comprehensive plan, propose detailed lists of projects to maintain existing assets, comply with regulatory mandates, and provide levels of service for Portland's residents and businesses. So starting with the Bureau of Environmental Services, they anticipate over $1.7 billion worth of investment over the next 20 years to protect public health, water quality, and the health of watersheds and the environment. This includes significant investment in sewer and stormwater collection systems to reduce the risk of flooding, basement backups, and sewer overflows. It also includes extending sewer connections to new development and existing unsewered areas, upgrading facilities at the city's two wastewater treatment plants to make sure they continue to meet regulatory requirements, and finally, improving the health of streams, wetlands, and other surface waterways, as well as the overall health of the city's watersheds to protect the public and meet regulations. So just want to note that in general, the citywide systems plan focuses on those major capital investments necessary to support existing and future Portlanders. But the Bureau of Environmental Services, as well as all our other bureaus, also plan to invest in ongoing operations and maintenance and other non-capital programs to meet the needs of customers. The Portland Water Bureau, to move on, anticipates over $1.5 billion in new investment over the next 20 years to address regulations, improve the conditions of aging infrastructure, and meet major maintenance needs. So a lot of this future investment, about 45%, is needed to improve the pump stations, mains, pumps, and meters within the distribution system. And that's to make sure that Portlanders receive reliable, clean, and cold water at their taps. Additionally, significant investment is needed to ensure the city's transmission conduits and reservoirs, those that bring water into the city and store it, can support the city's water needs, and then to improve water treatment facilities to meet future regulatory requirements. The Portland Bureau of Transportation has a separate document, the Transportation System Plan, which you have a work session later on to dive into depth on. That identifies projects and programs necessary to meet mobility and safety needs across the city. It proposes nearly $1.9 billion of investment over the next 20 years in its financially constrained scenario, and that really is intended to make multimodal improvements to make sure that pedestrians, bicyclists, motorists, freight movers, transit users, the full kind of spectrum of people and road users in the city can move around efficiently and effectively. It also would help create complete neighborhoods throughout Portland and support overall economic prosperity. So those three components that I just talked about, the environmental services, water, and transportation components, are required by the state, and we'll be submitting those as when adopted as the state's mandated public facilities plan. As Susan mentioned, Portland Parks and Recreation and the variety of other essential facilities and services have needs that are described in the plan, which I want to mention. And those we've noted in the plan are in excess of those requirements and are not considered part of that official public facilities plan. So for Parks and Recreation, the plan does identify infrastructure needs to make sure that all Portlanders have access to parks, recreation, and nature, and to meet the goals of Parks 2020. And for other essential facilities and services, we've looked at and have recommended improvements to civic facilities, the Portland Building, Portland 5 Centers for the Arts, the Veterans Memorial Coliseum, for example, to police, fire and rescue stations, as well as emergency response facilities like the West Side Emergency Response Center. And finally, to technology assets, major example is the replacement of public safety technology through the Public Safety Systems Revitalization Project. So that kind of represents the full spectrum of investment needs that we've called out in the plan. And I just wanted to open it up for questions on the infrastructure strategy.
I just want to make a comment. I very much appreciate this chart.
And I appreciate that you previewed the information that you're going to be talking
about. That you've previewed that that we'll have tailored strategies for each community. And I think I've always thought one of our big challenges when we talk about infrastructure and equity is moving people away from the idea that there's one metric, which, you know, if you looked at some mapping, you could show one metric and you say, where is Peabody investing? Where's Parks investing? Where's utilities? They tell such completely different stories based on completely different business models that they don't really help you get anywhere. So, for example, the easiest way to look at that is Commissioner Fritz has said that she's going to invest heavily in East Portland for parks. So she's taking SDC money and other money, plowing it. And so a map is going to show that East Portland is doing very well under her watch. Well, in a couple of years, if you look at the map of capital spending for the Water Bureau, you're going to think that why are we spending all this money in Northwest Portland? It doesn't show up as an area that's particularly deficient. Why are you spending a couple hundred million bucks? Well, the answer is there's a reservoir there, and the reservoir serves a broader community. But our the location of our core assets determines a lot about the expenditures for our capital spending, and we can't pick that reservoir and move it over to a place to get better equity score. I guess you could say conversely, the fortune we spent in Powell Butte and Kelly Butte made it maybe look for a while like we were heavily investing in East Portland. But again, that was the location of the reservoir. So I think the extent to which we can be very clear that each infrastructure bureau is different and how we define equity is nuanced in each. So for example, if we've got captive assets or whatever, I don't know what you call something that's already, you know, in place, and we're required to invest in it, the equity benchmark may be more what opportunities are we creating for people during the construction phase of something we're doing there, less than, you know, is East Portland getting their fair share of the investment we're making in reservoirs, because we can't equalize that. Our reservoir construction and some of our resilience money is not in East Portland. And that's not an equity consideration. That's where the assets are and where the how the CIP has been ranked. So, just in sum, we're going to have a big discussion about equity, particularly geographic equity, and where we put our resources. It's, I think, particularly complicated on the capital spending side because each of these infrastructure bureaus is different. And the extent to which you help us customize the narrative for each bureau so that, because we're not really talking equity with each bureau. They're so different. I think it's going to help the public understand the choices that we make.
I want to mention another issue and just maybe get some feedback from the team about when we're going to address it. Looking at the work sessions and the council hearings, there's an item in the outline, which no doubt there's been some good work already done on school facilities plan. And I want to raise that issue because it's a classic issue in that cities in Oregon don't operate the school system. And last time around, we were heading into a big growth phase. The Portland School District in particular had lost enrollment and so therefore had a lot of capacity in their system in terms of buildings and sites to accommodate growth. Now we're forecasting 250,000 more people in the city. PPS is growing at 400 students a year currently, and we have no formal control of their facilities planning or for any of the other districts in the city. Again, varying situations. Park Rose has capacity. David Douglas, I don't think, does. So I want to raise that issue in terms of both how we do our planning and what we do in our coordination. One just asterisk example of how bad it can get. In that conversation with Metro 20 years ago where I went and said, yes, we can accommodate more growth. And one of the ways we'll do it is we'll put 10,000 people in this old rail yard. And we did, or we're in the process of doing so. And the Portland school superintendent at the time turned down an offer of site from Hoyt Street Partners for a future school on the argument that, you know, kids would move in there as 20-somethings and move out as 28-year-olds with a baby and never, you know, never need a school. Oops, wrong. Got that one wrong. So we don't have a public school site in the Pearl District or in the South Waterfront, and we don't formally require them to be provided in the master planning process. So just want to throw that one out there and get some thoughts about how do we make sure we do as well as we can at getting it right this time, given that the Portland Public School District is going to run out of sites and existing buildings pretty soon after they reopen Madison, and given that at least one of the other districts in the city is already up against it and doesn't have a plethora of additional sites in their inventory as well.
We've done what I hope will be much more tightly coordinated work with the school districts with this comp plan than was done in 1980, and you know, that was potentially one of the shortcomings of that plan. So you'll see a robust element of that when we get to our land use map work session. That you mentioned the central city being one of the issues. Okay. So David Douglas is one of the six districts in Portland, and they're the one with the biggest issue in terms of the disconnect between their capacity to grow, just their bond capacity and their financial capacity to grow, and the enrollment growth that they're seeing given our land use plan. And so we've done some very deliberate land use changes within that district, and we'll be doing more of that as we get into the zoning level, potentially, and in some cases down-designating or reducing density within portions of the David Douglas School District, not as a permanent measure, but as a shorter term over the next 10 years measure to give them more room to breathing room. And so that will be a discussion that we have with the land use map.
So where in the comp plan is the city schools policy?
There are, in the public facilities chapter, I believe there are schools policies. We are recommending a new approach where we actually adopt the four school districts that have adopted facilities plans that we would adopt by reference their facilities plans. And for us, that means PPS and David Douglas at the moment.
No, I was thinking more in terms of the city's support for public schools and such that we have in the current comp plan.
That's take a look at the public facilities chapter. That's the section where we have public school facilities. But our role in the land use plan is primarily is in this enrollment balancing discussion, and that's what we focused on.
So maybe to wrap up, if you have specific questions you want to make sure that we get to, you know, we can maybe start each work session, follow on work session, kind of answering some of the questions from the last one to make sure that we keep some continuity. Things I heard definitely that you wanted out of the coming sessions was an opportunity to have a session with the city attorney to review language and appropriate topics and how we sort of have that balancing of risk, explaining more fully about public involvement, where that fits, because it's not just here and there, it's throughout the whole plan, but I want to make sure that if we want to draw it out as a separate issue and we want to draw it out as a separate component, that you have the opportunity to do that. We also want to look at, on this diagram here, making sure that we provide you information on the number of people that are in these various quadrants, who's being affected, and also give you background on their income, race issues, are they renters, are they homeowners, that kind of information. I think that will help you make decisions about investments. And then any specific issues you have for the bureaus that you oversee that you want to make sure you highlight. That helps us. And what we mentioned before you all came back was just the idea that at the beginning of each of the next sessions, coming back with some of the answers to the questions from the previous session so we can keep it going.
I'm sorry, I had to step out for a second there. I didn't hear the tail end of that discussion. does it, would it make sense to add schools to one of these work sessions in October, November?
It will be part of the land use work session.
It will be part of the November, yeah. November 10th session?
Yes.
Okay.
And to clarify, I don't necessarily think that the city attorney discussion should be in a work session. It would either be in an executive session or with all of us individually. I am interested, though, in looking at this community involvement. I have a question, too, about amendments. You know, Commissioner Fish brought up putting in specifically watersheds. How do you want to get our proposed amendments and when?
We will be... over the next month, our focus will be the work sessions and getting up to speed and starting to collect information. Then we'll have public hearings. We're anticipating after you have the first three public hearings that we'll want to take a pause for a month and work with each of your offices to collect what your perspective is and what if there are amendments to sort of gather those together. Then we would come back for a work session potentially in January and then move to vote. So we're anticipating that would probably happen after we have the initial round of public hearings, potentially then leaving open the option whether you want to have a wrap-up hearing at the end to discuss the amendments.
Just like any other thing that we deal with, sometimes you like to put those amendments out early so that you don't have, if you have agreement on them, you don't have, 300 people coming to talk about one issue that you're already agreed that you're probably going to amend later on. So we can pull those out early and try to put those on the table. That sort of happened at the Planning Commission, the Planning Sustainability Commission, the same way, where they knew there was a half dozen issues right off the bat that were in the original draft that they were going to change pretty quickly on so that we didn't have too much discussion. That said, people still want to come and talk about what they want to come talk about. So.
Right, I would appreciate that approach to get some early amendments in before the public hearing so that we can point out that, yes, they're already on the table.
So I guess one thing I'd like to see, and I think Tom indicated we have that, is a forecast of school-age children population over time. And then, so it's one thing to talk sort of lofty amendments like watersheds, but what about the down and dirty amendments like changing the zoning on a piece of property? Where's the right time to do that?
The land use discussion, we will try and, in the land use work session, we'll try and go over some of the highlights of that there. The Planning Commission experienced this as well, where, in addition to these higher level issues, you're going to hear a whole lot about specific properties. And we will try and use that final work session to give you an overview of some of the hotspots on that discussion.
So we will have the chance to, that's a participatory process where we can engage, because we've told lots of people who want a zone change, well, we're doing the comp plan, go talk to you. And yeah, and they have, but I'm sure some of them probably didn't get what they want. And, I want to be able to look at the situation and trying to persuade my colleagues that maybe we should make a change.
Maybe Andre or Kat, you could talk a little bit about that process, because what happened really was, we really did get it down to remarkably few number of properties that there was disagreement about on the Planning and Sustainability Commission, but they did literally get down to blocks and to individual properties. And that part of the process took us an extra whole meeting, maybe meeting and a half, to make sure people really understood, well, what we had pictures of each of those lots and what's next to it and who owns it and what's the history. And luckily, we didn't get into that kind of detail on the 40,000 properties that are having some sort of change to their potential comp plan designation, but it was probably 30 that it got down to. So
I certainly appreciate that. I think possibly Commissioner Saltzman is referring to properties like ESCO that have been to visit all of us that people didn't realize they needed to get it on the table at the Planning Commission. And so now that the mayor has given some interviews on television today about the comprehensive plan and what it is, and so have you, Susan, people are going to be aware that, oh, this is my opportunity, the once-in-a-lifetime proposal for changes. So could you please, for those folks maybe watching at home or following along, state where to give input? Because one of the things that happens is that people will email all five of us, but then not email the staff who are going to be processing the requests. And so there's a lot of staff work in sending things to the right place to get on the list. So could we be sure that that's posted prominently on the front page of Portland Online and stays that way until after we're done.
Good idea. Good idea. Because, yeah, there obviously have been 4,000 people involved so far. That will continue and maybe even accelerate.
Susan, we've already gotten some instructions from your team. I just want to make sure we're clear. First is, I think you said that no more than 10 amendments per office. So that's nothing. I don't know who that was. I don't know who that was directed to, but I think we may have a disagreement. And second, you asked that as we got constituent concerns, I'm a property owner or business owner. This thing is not. I don't like the where this is going. We were supposed to forward them to you. We obviously are tracking them. The perfect outcome is that at some point we hear from the people that have contacted us specifically, hey, I'm fine with what the Planning Bureau has come up with. And I'm heartened to hear that you think we can get it down to a small universe, and then we can sort of go through. Because my guess is that many of the concerns that we've heard collectively. I mean, a savvy person is going to send it to all five, not just one. But if you've worked through a lot of them, then we'll get to that smaller universe, and then, as Dan said, have an interactive process just to make sure that we understand, where you landed.
We have
on changes to properties. The reason that we took some extra time is. When you start changing properties, it's a cascade effect. So there's some principles that we agreed to as a commission of, if we change here, we look at a broad, because coming in and looking at one property in isolation, you have other properties that have similar characteristics, similar issues, and if you do it here, the other person's gonna come in and say, how come not my property? So we work with staff to give us kind of, here's the characteristics of a certain type of change, and that change affects what? So we understood the ramifications of saying, this specific property sounded like a good deal, yep, but now all of a sudden you move over to another neighborhood, and that property doesn't sound like a good deal. And I would encourage you to understand the ramifications, because in isolation, a lot of things look really good in terms of change, either saying no or saying yes, but you need to look at other neighborhoods. And so when we looked at even neighborhoods, some neighborhoods didn't meet our criteria when we laid out that criteria, and other neighborhoods did. And so have that conversation, work with staff to do it, because you will get that other person coming in. That delayed us, because we had all those other people come in and say, raise their hand. And they do watch. And you're right to get them in early.
Where do we, how do we get the list of the 30 or 40 specific areas that you did look at so we know how you dispensed it with them?
We can definitely bring that early on. We can get that to you now so that you're prepared before the land use work session, so that you can say, here were the 20 kind of hot topics, because it really did come down to some key issues, and it wasn't just key individual properties. We're like, well, if we're going to do that here, these people over here now know that you did that for them, and they want the same deal or something, and so we wanted to be consistent as much as possible.
Just kind of to go back to the comment about how does this tie into zoning code. And this all plays into that, because if you aren't careful about it, you're setting up conditional use provisions kind of down in the future. And so we had a lot of time and discussion based on, what does this mean at this level? What does it mean kind of at the zoning code level? Because if you make the change here, like Andre's getting at, does it start rippling and creating other issues? And staff will do a fabulous job of walking you through kind of how those two are tied together. But it really helped in having that criteria basis that Andre talked about, to kind of think through, okay, what does that mean for a potential conditional use in the future? And therefore, how do you implement this later? So staff, as they're looking at a conditional use request, can go, well, this was the basis that you all and we all made this decision on in the first place. And they can kind of keep going back to that criteria. So you might want to tweak that criteria, and we may not have landed it perfectly, but it's a great starting point.
Two things I want to mention. One is we do have biweekly meetings set up with all of your staff to talk about logistics of, you know, coordinate, for example, have you received this letter from so-and-so, and have you also got a copy of that, and just some of the more basic stuff. So we'll be doing that. I think the first one is Thursday, or the second one. The other thing I want to mention is Commissioner Novick couldn't be here today, but he did send us a list of 5 questions, and I just wanted to quickly put the topics of those on the table. He asked us about the relative balance of growth in centers and corridors versus infill in neighborhoods and what the right mix of that is, and he indicated he wanted to talk about that. He asked about residential preferences in housing and how that affected our plan. He asked about Vision Zero and specifically the transportation investments, how they were tailored to advance that priority in PBOT. He asked about the how the growth scenarios, the different ways we could grow, would affect the cost of city services more from a ratepayer, I think, perspective. We looked at it from a capital side, but he asked the ratepayer question. And then the final one was about density and transit and the relationship there, and how far are we going towards supporting the kind of transit system with our land use plan.
Other questions, points, or follow-up that anyone needs?
I want to emphasize again what you were saying about the challenge of this process, where we're going to be asked to make changes on specific properties, which there is a quasi-judicial process to do that. And as the mayor doubtless remembers, as do I, with the last time we tried to do an area plan in 1995 with Southwest Community Plan, it blew up when people started looking at their particular properties, the adjacent properties. And so we are currently bound by our current comprehensive plan. There is a process for doing amendments to the comprehensive plan, and I think we need to be really mindful of deferring to the Planning Commission, having done their due diligence, and at the same time, when something comes up that, like ESCO, is a clear, oops, we didn't quite get there, how does that affect other properties, and would others like to be made aware of these opportunities?
Well, I want to thank everyone for this good start to a very in-depth process that we're now scrolling the council into. So look forward to it is fun. If this isn't fun, you shouldn't be in the business. Thank you very much.
Thank you.